hear argument first in number 2010-1439, Roche Diagnostics against LifeScan et al. Mr. Drutges, when you're ready. Is that the correct pronunciation of the name?
It is. It is. It is. Very good, Your Honor. May it please the court, this court should construe the claim term electrode as used in the 146, 146, and 147 patents as a microelectrode extending up to about 1,000 microns and reverse the district court's decision of non-infringement based on inherent claim construction for three crucial reasons. First of all, the plain meaning and unambiguous of an unambiguous technical term confirms that a microelectrode extends up to 1,000 microns. The abbreviation micro in microelectrode itself stands for something that is measured in micrometers or microns, as opposed to millimeters or nanometers.
Now that was somewhat at odds with the position you took in the district court, I take it.
Well, no, Your Honor. The position that Roche took in the district court was that the defendant's proposed construction was incorrect for two reasons. First of all, the limitation to microelectrodes that was proposed by defendants. And second of all, the limitation of the range of microelectrodes of anything less, or electrodes of anything less than 1,000 microns.
But you were advocating below that the court construe electrodes to include macroelectrodes, right?
Originally, that there should be no limitation to microelectrodes whatsoever.
And macroelectrodes, at that point, as I understood it, you were including the 100 to 1,000 microns range.
The statements made at oral argument were directed to defendant's proposed construction, Your Honor. And based on defendant's proposed construction, which would be microelectrodes of 100 microns or less, the examples 3 to 5 of the 146 patent would indisputably be macroelectrodes and not microelectrodes under that construction. So too would the examples set forth in the Excalibur report dated 1997, which is part of the intrinsic record, with all of which clearly established unequivocally that those electrodes of 300, 500, and 1,000 microns were microelectrodes.
How does that answer Judge Bryson's question?
Again, the statements by Roche at oral argument and claim construction were directed to defendant's proposed construction and pointing out that the defendant's proposed construction was contradicted by the intrinsic evidence.
What was your proposed construction? Wasn't it that electrodes would include macroelectrodes? Wasn't that your proposed construction?
That basically electrodes should not be limited to anything less than the term electrodes, which would include both micro and macroelectrodes. That's correct. The issue was, again, though, in reference to defendant's proposed claim construction, and that the limitation attempted to be imposed by defendants onto the term electrode, which is microelectrodes of 100 microns or less, would be at odds with the intrinsic evidence. And it's really the intrinsic evidence that controls here.
In your motion for reconsideration on the claim construction issue, of which we have a redacted copy that we got, Pacer, you averred to Judge Farnan that additional evidence and additional expert testimony had been adduced since the claim construction briefing, and that those data points of additional information you believed supported your petition for reconsideration. Could you just tick off for us, like bullet style, what the additional evidence was and the expert discovery to which you were referring in your petition for reconsideration?
Certainly. Defendants have asserted that the third paragraph of the detailed description of the 146 and 147 patents in column 4 sets forth some kind of a definition. And although Roche disputes that, that is a definition of the term microelectrode.
Is that the language in column 4?
That's the language in column 4. That's correct. That third paragraph of the detailed description. The first sentence, the topic sentence of that.
Well, that's not new.
No, that's correct. The topic sentence of that paragraph refers to the general understanding in the art. Among the evidence that is before the court in reconsideration is the electrochemical methods textbook of Barton Faulkner, which establishes...
That was not before the court before the motion for reconsideration?
That's correct, Your Honor. And that is that came out during expert discovery and was... we became aware of it during expert discovery. And it clearly establishes that the term microelectrode extends up to 1 millimeter.
Whose textbook is this?
Barton Faulkner's Electrochemical Methods textbook.
Barton Faulkner.
That's correct. And that is at A1048 to 1050. The Electrochemical Dictionary also unequivocally establishes that the term microelectrode extends up to 1,000 microns. And that, dated from 2008, confirms that that meaning of microelectrode hasn't changed from before this application was filed all the way up to the current date.
So your challenge isn't to Judge Farnan's Markman ruling. Your challenge is predicated on evidence adduced after the ruling came forward. Before Judge Farnan.
Even the ruling itself, Your Honor, the Excalibur report, which is part of the intrinsic evidence and is unquestionably refers to the examples 3 through 5 of the 146 patent, the 300, 500, and 1,000 micron configurations as microelectrodes. There can be really no dispute about that. The Excalibur report's very clear on its face.
But did you make the argument to Judge Farnan that what you're saying now, that the plain meaning of microelectrodes extends up to 1,000? That wasn't an argument you were making to Judge Farnan, correct? Because your position before him was that the patent includes macroelectrodes.
First of all, the position that Roche was making or asserting before Judge Farnan was that the claim term electrode cannot be construed to exclude the 300, 500, and 1,000 configurations that are set forth in the Excalibur report, that are set forth in examples 3 to 5,
but I thought,
and fall within the plain meaning of the term microelectrode.
But I thought what we were talking about with Judge Clevenger was how one skilled in the art would construe the term microelectrode. Am I wrong about that?
That is also supportive evidence. The plain meaning of the term microelectrode also supports construction.
What else was new besides this textbook?
During expert testimony, Dr. Higson, Nova's expert, admitted that electrodes of up to 1,000 microns would have a degree of non-planar diffusion and therefore would have the, quote, mix of non-planar and a planar path diffusion that is discussed in the third paragraph of the detailed description.
But that was not before Judge Farnan earlier?
That was not before Judge Farnan earlier. Expert discovery didn't take place until after the Markman hearing was held. So both of those things, in our view, clearly support, again, the plain meaning of the term microelectrode as extending up.
Anything else?
No. No, Your Honor.
So just those two items were then things that were not previously before Judge Farnan?
That's correct. There was let me restate that. There is also the Musho reference. The Musho reference was cited by Dr. Higson, Nova's expert, in his report as a clear example of the use of the term microelectrode in the art. The Musho reference and its counterpart are both prior art. One of the Musho references, which contains that same disclosure, is in the intrinsic evidence that was cited to the examiner during the prosecution. And that establishes, again, that microelectrodes are not limited to 100 microns, but extend well above that range.
I think Judge Prost had a question.
Referring back to the planar, non-planar reference that you made a few minutes ago, in column 4, when it speaks to that in that sentence, it does seem to limit, does it not, the size of the electrodes to less than 100?
I take issue with that, Your Honor, no.
Okay.
The last sentence of that paragraph, first of all, talks about a mix of planar and non-planar paths being a microelectrode. The phrase that follows is, especially if the diffusion occurs predominantly in a non-planar path, or if the size of the electrodes is less than 100 microns. The term especially modifies both of those if phrases. There's no question about that.
Well, let's assume we disagree with that. Where does that leave you? I assume that doesn't change your position.
If you read especially out of that sentence, Your
Honor. Well, no, I'm not suggesting we read it out of the sentence. I'm suggesting we read it as applying only to the first portion of the phrase and not to the second.
I think first of all we'd be left with a question of whether a electrode of up to 1,000 microns would still have a mix of planar and non-planar diffusion. But I think even still, there's the issue of whether that's an actual limitation that should be read into the claims or not. But certainly, in our view, especially modifies both of those if phrases. And in fact, every single reference to 100 microns or less throughout the specification is preceded by the term either especially, typical, or preferred, which in our view confirms that each of those are preferred embodiments. And under the precedent of this court, which is expressly rejected, importing preferred embodiments into the claims should be.
How do we know if examples 3, 4, and 5 can be used to test blood?
Well, there is nothing in the specification that the
claims are drawn to testing blood, right?
That's correct. First of all, there's nothing in the
specification. An example that was drawn to testing non-blood would be impertinent, right?
First of all, a microelectrode is a structural component, and to construe the term microelectrode differently depending upon what solution is being used with it, I would submit is an improper construction. Second of all, the dependent claims, claim 48, for instance, of the 146 patent, clearly establishes that the range of 25 to 200 microns can be used.
Your adversary says that's a vestigial organ of some sort.
Well, I understand that that's the appellee's argument, but of course, ignoring claims in the course of claim construction, simply on the basis that there's some that it's some kind of vestigial organ.
Where did claim 48 come from?
Claim 48 was in the. Prosecution from, I believe, in one form or another, since roughly the filing of the utility applications.
Not in the provisional.
It was not in the provisional.
Not in the provisional. So that's didn't correct. It come in as an amendment to the application that ended up as the 146?
That's correct.
And it came in when Claim 1 was amended?
I believe that's roughly
Claim correct. 1 used to have that very specific limitation. And then they took it out and said the depth suitable for capillary flow?
Mm-hmm. That's correct. And so, again,
why was that amendment made?
I, at this stage, we do not know, Your Honor. But what is clear, though, is that Claim 1 with blood, or Claim 36 with blood, has to be construed as encompassing that 25 to 200 micron depth limitation. Certainly, the examiner would not have allowed that the dependent Claim 48.
Well, I suppose your argument is that Exhibits 3, 4, and 5 enable Claim 48.
No, our position is that examples 3, 4, and 5 are among other things, simply examples.
Where is 48 enabled?
I'm sorry?
Where is Claim 48 enabled in the patent, if not in Exhibits 4, 5, and 6?
Well, we come back to this enablement argument. Defendants, appellees here, have never raised an enablement or lack of enablement argument in with respect to any of these claims, including Claim 48 in the proceedings below. All expert testimony has taken place at this stage. All expert reports are in, and we've submitted the expert reports of both Nova's and LifeScan's expert. Not one of them have suggested that claim is not enabled. Second of all, the fact that the very, very small electrodes were enabled in connection with the original example in the provisional application. I mean, those very small electrodes are actually the toughest case. It's getting to larger electrodes that are within the skill of the person of ordinary art as far as being able to improve contact area, improve electrical flow, that sort of thing. So the fact that the smaller microelectrodes are enabled clearly leaves the larger microelectrodes.
If we were to decide, much to your chagrin, that examples 4, 5, and 6 are to be excluded in the claim construction exercise, as Judge Farnan did, then what's the support in the claim to support your interpretation of it reaching up to 1,000 microns?
Well, first of all, we come back to the plain meaning of the term micro.
Well, that's what we don't know what that means.
Well, again,
it means a certain number of microns.
It's something that's, in our view, measured in microns.
What else in the patent would support up to 1,000 if we chuck out the three examples?
The fact that every reference to 100 microns or less is prefaced with a reference to preferred, especially, or typical. The Excalibur report, which is part of the intrinsic evidence, which establishes that...
But on that theory... On that theory, the size could go up to 2,000 or 3,000.
No, there's a. There, first of all, there's a limit. There's a limit that is imposed to the size of the electrode, based on the district court's finding of a disavowal of the term macro electrode.
1,600 or whatever.
That's right. That's right. I think 1,600 would certainly be the upper limit. And the and that's really why that at this stage in our view any kind of a width limitation be appropriate given the judge's finding of disavowal in that case.
We've used up all of your rebuttal time with questions, but we will restore it since we've taken a lot of your time. You had reserved, I think, 5 minutes. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So we'll give the other side an extra 6 minutes if we could do. Thank you, Mr. Jones. So the appellees will be dividing their time. Ms. Bork, you're going to go first. Now, the two of you have an extra 6 minutes. You can divide it as you choose, but otherwise we'll just proceed and you keep an eye on the clock.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The district court's construction of the electrode terms as microelectrodes having widths up to approximately 100 microns should be affirmed for three reasons. Number one, reading the specification as a whole, the microelectrode invention is consistently described as having an upper limit of 100 microns. Number two, there is no...
Consistently? You say it's consistently described?
Correct.
Where consistently means like more than once?
It's in column 3 under the summary of the invention, which describes the invention as a whole and provides the dimensions and a range of dimensions and sets forth an upper limit of 100 microns there.
Under the preferred embodiment?
No. That summary of invention at column 3 is, we contend, is describing the invention, the microelectrode invention as a whole. Yes, indeed, the term preferred is used in that column, but that term cannot be used to broaden the scope of the invention beyond what the inventor described as his invention. You can contrast what is described in column 3 with other parts of the specification which are describing the preferred embodiment, such as at column 5, lines 33 to 37, or even the common example 1, which is at column 20. But if I may just quickly run through the specification to show why that is the upper limit.
Before you do that, did you want to hit the other two points quickly? That you said there were three basic reasons to begin with. And so
certainly.
You get those points in. Otherwise, I'm sure that the questioning will...
Certainly. The second point was there is no teaching in the specification that the microelectrodes of the invention can be as large as 1,000 microns.
Okay. And the third?
The third is that the added examples 3 through 5 are macroelectrodes, not microelectrodes, as Roche told the district court and as the inventor so testified. They cannot be used to broaden the scope of the claims beyond the invention described in the specification.
Okay. Why don't you go back to your...
Okay. Turning to the specification, we start with column 3. Column 3 describes the invention as a whole and provides a range of dimensions for that microelectrode invention and sets forth the upper limit of 100. That takes us to column 4, where the inventor describes the desired properties of the microelectrode invention, namely this non-planar diffusion. The microelectrodes have non-planar diffusion. Macroelectrodes, in contrast, have planar diffusion. And goes on at the end to describe the fact, and the, not, let me back up a minute, the planar, non-planar diffusion desired for this microelectrode invention is achieved by controlling the size of the electrodes. That's why there is an upper limit.
Now, what is it, what in the record tells us the extent of non-planar diffusion for an electrode of a thousand microns?
If reading the specification of these patents, one understands that electrodes of that large size are going to have substantially planar diffusion.
Well, where do we see that? I had a hard time finding an actual statement anywhere that says that at a certain size, the diffusion becomes substantially planar, even though there are references to the fact that the degree of planar diffusion, of course, increases with increases in size. And in fact, I think your opposing counsel cited an expert testimony that was to the effect that non-planar diffusion continues to occur up to 1,000 microns.
Well, let me address the sure. last aspect first. The expert's testimony, both LifeScan's expert, Dr. Williams, and Nova's expert, Dr. Higson, testified that a 1,000 micron electrode would exhibit purely macroelectrode type behavior and would be experiencing planar diffusion overwhelmingly. And that is at appendix site 1958. LifeScan's expert, Dr. Williams, testified that the non-planar diffusion of with electrodes of that size would be insignificant and undetectable. And that's at appendix 1949. And that would not be observable in any experiment. Again, that's at appendix 1947.
Did they happen to have testified as to the point at which non-planar diffusion becomes no longer a substantial portion of the diffusion?
No, I don't believe they did. I don't think that was an issue. It wasn't an issue.
It's a pretty important issue now.
Well, all along, throughout the litigation, Roche took the position that the term electrodes in the claims of these patents covered both macroelectrodes
and microelectrodes. I understand. At least they say not so, but I understand your point on that. But certainly at this point, and presumably at the point that they went back with the motion for reconsideration to Judge Farnan, that was no longer their argument. So this, assuming we're not going to hold them to the position they initially took, then that raises the question of what? How do we get at this definition of microelectrode? Do we limit it to 100? Do we say that it's limited to either 100 or something that continues to show predominantly non-planar diffusion? If the latter, then it's pretty important that we know, well, when does that happen? And what you're telling us is there's nothing in the record that tells us that.
Well, there is a further teaching in the specification, okay. And I would ask the court to look at column 15, lines 55 through 65, where it teaches you how to achieve the desired non-planar diffusion. And it does that by limiting the size of the electrodes to a range of 5 to 50 microns, most preferably 10 to 50 microns. So when you take that in conjunction with the teaching in column 4, what you glean from that is that the upper limit of 100 microns, quite frankly, is overgenerous. And I do want to address another issue that was raised by Roche's counsel, which is the term microelectrode at the time the provisional application was filed in 2001 did not have a plain and ordinary meaning. The first time Roche argues that is now on appeal. And in fact, if you look at the very extrinsic evidence to which they referred this court, this Bard and Faulkner treatise at footnote 1, appendix site 1047, it shows, in fact, that the term microelectrode did not have a defined size in the art. In fact, it was always changing, as everything does in the electronics fields. Everything gets smaller. So what did the inventor do to make certain people knew what his microelectrode invention was? He placed an upper limit on the size of the electrodes to be 100. He was clearly aware of these larger electrodes that were in his Excalibur report that is dated in 1997. He was clearly aware of those when he filed his provisional application in 2001, and he decided to describe his invention as a microelectrode invention having an upper limit of 100 microns. He did not take into consideration these larger electrodes that were in the Excalibur report. Instead, he put an upper limit on it. And it wasn't until 2002 when Roche filed one of the applications leading to these patents in suit that they added these later examples, these examples 3 through 5. And they did that for the specific purpose to get a broad construction of the term electrode to cover LifeScan's commercial product that had come on the market that had macro electrodes. And they maintained that construction. That electrode meant micro and macro all the way up through the litigation using examples 3 to 5 to support it. And it wasn't until that Judge Farnan found against them that they reversed their position and came back and said, no, these undisputably macro electrodes are now micro electrodes.
Did I hear you say that in the provisional application they limited themselves to 100? Just a minute ago, is that what you said?
No, I said, I did, because that forms the basis of the common specification, which gives you
the provisional application had sort of greater than 15. There was no limit.
That was the claims in the provisional application did that. That's correct. But I mean that the...
You went kind of fast in your talking, and I thought you were telling me that the inventor had limited himself in the provisional application to 100 microns of width.
He did, because if it's the common
He didn't, because claim 1 says just a width greater than 15.
So that's assuming that there's some claim differentiation that you can reach between those. But the provisional, he didn't even have to have claims in his provisional application. He called them microelectrodes. He didn't have these larger sized electrodes in there. There's no disclosure anywhere in the specification of microelectrodes being as large as 1,000. And I see I'm out of my time.
Other than example three, right?
Examples 3 to 5.
Yeah.
Which are only in one of the patents.
And why is it that we throw those, as Farnan did, we throw those three exhibits out? Why?
Number one, they're macroelectrodes, as Roche told the district court, as the inventor testified.
You haven't responded to his argument. He said, yes. We said, if you buy Nova's claim construction, if you buy their claim construction, then of course the examples are macro. Because you said micro is limited to 100. So that's the complete answer, which you have to address to your, they confessed that the exhibits are macros, have said that we said that in comparison to your claim construction argument.
They took a consistent position that the term electrode covered both macro and micro electrodes, and they used for support examples 3 to 5. They told the district court, the inventor testified, and the inventor's testimony is at Appendix site 21-144. The inventor testified in this case that examples 3 through 5 were macro electrodes. It wasn't until their position was rejected that what were undisputably macro electrodes now became magically micro electrodes. That's
and
plain, Roche's, fast, and
Roche's
loose
response
picture.
To that is that we generally discount inventor testimony.
The other point I'd like to...
Isn't that, what's your response to that? It's true that the inventor said that exhibits 3 to 5 were macro. And he probably wasn't saying that in response to your claim construction, but we do have case law that says, well, believe it or not, we really don't care what inventors think they invented.
Well, I think it's consistent with what he did in, when he filed his provisional application, and he called it a microelectrode invention, and he did not include those examples in his originally filed application. It wasn't only until later when
His provisional application had no, and its independent claim had no limit whatsoever. Presumably could have gone from 15 to whatever.
Those aren't the claims that have to be construed in the patents at suit right now. The claims are different than that right now.
I understand that, but there's a lot of argument in this case that we're supposed to trace back to the provisional so we can really see what's going on here.
I would submit that the provisional application is limited to microelectrodes and that the fact that...
But that just begs the question of what the max, what the out, the maximum dimension of a microelectrode is. That was the presiding judge's question from the get-go.
But that's that's been my point. That's why they put the upper limit of 100 on it, because the claim term did not have a plain and unambiguous meaning in the art. The extrinsic evidence that Roche itself relies on shows that it didn't. That's why he placed the upper limit of 100 there. And if you read the specification consistently from column 3 to column 4 to column 15 and throughout, there is no disclosure anywhere in that specification of electrodes having a larger size than 100 all the way up to 1,000, with the exception of
the exception of
the added examples.
Now, this is a three-exhibit case.
And they are only in one of the patents, not the other patent.
Is that...
What do we make of that?
What do we make of that?
Because...
don't want to win half this case, I take it.
The claim terms, common claim terms in related applications, as this court has so held, should be construed consistently.
Well, that doesn't tell us which way to construe the claim, whether we construe the 147 as containing the same or the 146 as the 147.
The other point about these added examples is they can only find support for this macro electrode from these added examples, which came in 2002, and it's undisputed that LifeScan's commercial product was on the market more than a year before those examples were added, so that they would have anticipatory art against those claims. One other point I'd like to make on examples 3 to 5, and then I'm going to sit down, is that Patent Office also found that those examples could not support an invention date of 1997 because they weren't used with blood. And that is at appendix site 1023 in 1297-98.
Before you sit down, and if we could stop the clock from running for a moment. I just wanted to clarify one point for housekeeping purposes. You have designated in your brief, various materials as confidential, including some of the materials that you've discussed here. In particular, the inventor's testimony. I take it the parties do not have any problem with our reference to the referencing the inventor's testimony in any discussion or opinion that may come. I mean, these confidentiality references are vestigial in that they may have been part of an agreement that was reached early on but no longer has effect. Can the two parties, or three parties, if necessary, let us know now, preferably, or later, if need be, whether you have any continuing interest in maintaining confidentiality with respect to any of the materials in the red brief?
Oh, certainly we can. My understanding is that it's all Roche confidential information. The inventor testimony to which I cited here, I believe, had been de-designated. But
well,
I will have to
check
that.
It's designated. I paid attention to this because when I was reading the brief, I was thinking, how are we going to talk about this? You saved us that trouble by being the first to mention the inventor testimony, but I just maybe Roche can give us the answer to this. You, and I take it your co-counsel, have no problem with excising the confidentiality requirements?
LifeScan certainly doesn't.
No problem. And Roche, I think, if to the extent it hasn't already waived, it will.
We will regard the confidentiality designation then as punctus officio. All right. Thank you. Now, Mr. Jones, how much time is left total for the appellees, given the additional time that we granted? Do you have a...
Yes, sir. We have a total of 9.5 minutes.
And that will include rebuttal. You've saved a couple of minutes for rebuttal. So
yes,
you can
Your Honor.
Go ahead.
I hate to wade into the microelectrode issue because I've got a lot of issues to cover, but I did want to respond, Judge Clevenger, to your question. If I understand your question correctly, I think the answer is that examples 3 to 5 are unclaimed embodiments because they don't relate to blood. So therefore, I don't think it's proper to take those into account when you're construing claims that relate to blood.
You know,
that would be my answer to that question.
I saw your argument on that, and perhaps it wasn't yours, perhaps it was LifeScan's. But in any event, it struck me that the unclaimed embodiment argument misses the point that is most potentially important about examples 3 through 5. It's not whether they are within the scope of the claims or not. It is what they tell us about the meaning of microelectrode. Because this patent is a patent which is specifically designated as applying to microelectrodes. And setting aside Roche's earlier statements in before the district court and whether they may have been consistent with that notion, if one starts with the proposition that this patent is all about microelectrodes, everything in the patent is about microelectrodes, then it's pretty good evidence as to what a microelectrode is that these three examples say electrodes up to 1,000 microns. Well, that's, it seems to me, the pertinence of the examples, not whether they're claimed or not claimed or enabled or not enabled. They're in the text of the specification.
Yeah, I understand that, Your Honor. But there are patents where people throw things in, and this was new material. And in fact, I think Ms. Berg touched on this, and this kind of touches on our cross appeal and the counterclaims that we asserted. Material was put into the patents in an attempt to broaden out the claims improperly, we think, to try to capture products in infringement. So that's why it's there, but I certainly understand your point. It is there, and it's something that the court has to deal with.
So, okay. Go ahead.
So my plan, and I know we've been running a long time, and so subject to what the court would like me to do, I'd like to touch on the alternate grounds for affirmance on the patent side and then head to the cross appeal. So I'll start in, but if you'd like me to use my time, otherwise just let me know, and I'm sure you will. We in our brief, and Roche, and I'm sorry that LifeScan didn't deal with this, we think there's another claim construction issue where Judge Farnan got it wrong, and that's that the detecting step should include a delay prior to the application of the voltage. And if you take a look at that at the claim language that's involved in, say, claim 31 of the 147, it talks about following the detecting step, and this is claim 31-146, applying or controlling the voltage. And I think that what you can read into that language is that the voltage is applied after the following the detection step. And the detection step includes a delay. And why does the patent teach a delay? The patent teaches a delay to allow the sample to mix with the chemicals before the current is established that can actually measure the glucose concentration. Now, how do we know that...
What harm would be done if you apply the voltage from the beginning?
Well,
what effect would it have on the initiation of the reaction between the glucose and the flexible substrate?
Well, based on the teachings of the patent, it is applied. It's applied initially, and then it's stopped, and you have this open circuit and delay for it to settle down.
Okay, but why is that something that's important for reasons other than just to save battery time?
Well, the inventor thought it was important, and if you look at the inventor testimony...
Help me out here. What is it that, in your view... makes this something other than just a sort of happenstance feature of the language of the claim? I mean, you know, if they claimed it that way and they're stuck with it.
Right.
So if that's your argument, that's fine. But if there's some more to it than that, then I'd like to know what it is. In other words, there is a scientific reason that one would want to have a delay, but in your system, you've overcome that problem.
That's what I'm looking for. If you have an answer like that, I would like to know what it is.
Well, my answer to that question is, you know, if you give it time to settle down and to get a complete reaction, you're perhaps going to get a more accurate number when you reapply the voltage because you've allowed the chemical reaction to take place. Rather than applying the voltage right through and measuring the current from the beginning, you may have an incomplete mixing of the blood with the chemicals.
You'll
and so when you delay, you'll allow it to settle down.
Well, but you'll certainly get a different measurement before there's been a complete reaction, sure.
That's right.
But does the application, or is there anything in the record that would suggest that applying the voltage from the get-go has the effect of interfering with the reaction? I'll put it that way.
I'm not aware of anything to that effect.
All right.
And just if you take a look at the specification, all the examples describe this drop detect, and I know that's not the end of the story. But if you take a look at the specification in column 7, it talks about amperometric applications, right? And it describes how this applies to amperometry, and that's through column 8, line 15. And there it talks about delay. In the summary of the invention, they talk about detecting and thereafter applying the voltage. In column 13, line 36, again, they talk about delay when they're talking about the invention. So this is throughout, and in fact, right on the front page of the patent, they've got figure 7, and it talks about a delay. It was very clear that that delay was thought to be required to conduct this invention in an accurate manner. And in fact, they distinguish
your adversary's argument is, yes, it's preferably achieved, but not necessary.
Well,
so it's a little bit like the size of the electrode argument, preferred embodiments, right? All the preferred embodiments here show a delay.
Well, Your Honor,
why should we limit the claim to that?
Well, because I think that when they do discuss the delay, for example, when they're talking about the amperometric application, they're not talking about a preferred embodiment. When they're talking about, in the summary of the invention, they're not talking about the preferred embodiment, nor in column 13, line 36, when they talk about the array.
An example of the method involves a catalytic used in amperometry, right?
Well, they say, column 7, they say the sensor of the invention may be used in amperometric applications. I'm looking at line 41. And then it talks about the delay, after a short delay time, at the column 8,
maybe
line 14. I guess the way I read this is that, you know, if the specification could talk, it would say use a delay. And they don't always use it with the preferred embodiment. And I think the other evidence is consistent with that. If you look at the prosecution history, they distinguish claims based on the fact that you can't combine amperometry with a delay, such as what's disclosed in the patent application, with coulometry. So they distinguish that. In fact, Judge Farnan found that to be the case. He found that they had basically distinguished prior art, but he didn't take the next step, which was to say that they had disclaimed it, which I would urge this court to do, because to me, that's a disclaimer of amperometry that does not have a delay. Whether they needed the delay or not, it doesn't impact on how these claims should be construed. And then, of course, there's the inventor testimony, and we cite that at A10, A24, to A25, where he said you needed a delay. So this is what they thought. Whether they needed it or not, that's what they thought, and that's how the patent was drafted, and that's how the application was prosecuted. So I'll move on to the cross appeal, unless there's questions.
Go ahead.
Now, there's three issues. There's the preclusion of key evidence. That's number one, the choice of law issue, and then the denial of the JMOL. I'll start with the preclusion of evidence. I in my opening, tried to get into the record evidence of unfair competition and breach of contract was that Roche had sued they spurred a patent application. This Woolsey application was spurred from the technology that we disclosed to them. And then we were sued. Our client was sued and had to spend millions of dollars defending the suit. I tried that to get that evidence into the record. It was evidence of unfair competition and breach of contract. Roche objected. The objection was sustained. We spoke to Judge Farnan at the end of the day. He said, I'm not to bring up the lawsuit. the fact of the lawsuit or the result. We move on. Mr. Drutches is cross-examining my client, the CEO. He asks him a question about how Nova has been hurt by this, by the Wilsey application. My client's not allowed to respond. I told my client not to respond about the lawsuit because I've been ordered not to bring it up. I asked for a sidebar. Judge Farnan said, well, I can't let you respond to that, even though Mr. Drutches has opened the door, because then I've got to give them a chance to respond. Now, that was not an analysis under 402, 403. It was simply a time management issue.
That's part of what 403 is about.
Yes, yes. Maybe, Your Honor, but the door had been opened now to the harm issue. He's basically now told the jury, and because we couldn't respond, that we've not been harmed by what they've done. So now that's two errors, I propose, that have been made. And so I wasn't given a chance to respond to that. The jury is thinking we have not been harmed because we can't respond. Then Mr. Drutches, in the closing, gets up and he says that Nova initiated the litigation to seek retribution because Roche didn't partner with them. And again, I can't bring up the lawsuit to say they sued us first. We didn't initiate the lawsuit. So now the jury is thinking, you are now in this courtroom to seek retribution and you've not been harmed. This I suggest, is prejudicial error, highly prejudicial with the jury. And, the standard on appeal is that an error is harmless only if it is highly probable that the error did not affect the outcome. I would suggest that that error did affect the outcome. It's highly probable that it did affect the outcome. It tarnished Nova's reputation and was just unduly prejudicial. I'd like to move on to the choice of law.
Nova says it went on that, just on that last point. Nova, Roche said, well, you didn't object. When Nova's lawyer asked your client how he was hurt, you didn't object.
Well, I asked for a sidebar, Your Honor, and that was effectively an objection. And I think we've cited some case law that would suggest that my asking for a sidebar and having a detailed discussion and expressing my objection, even though I didn't use the word object, with Judge Farnan, there was a long dialogue at sidebar about this, that effectively is an objection. So I believe that I preserved my rights. I was ordered twice not to bring up that lawsuit. The choice of law, again, I'm sorry, was there?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry, I thought you had a question. The choice of law, Judge Farnan, because it's a choice of law provision in the NDA, he applied Swiss law to all the claims. We had claims to not just breach of contract, we had unfair competition, misappropriation of trade secrets, and also conversion. He applied the choice of law provision, which was Swiss law, to all of the claims. That knocked out two of our claims and raised the standard of evidence or our standard of proof on the unfair competition claim. Under Delaware law, which was the proper law for him to apply, he should have done an analysis under the restatement. And he has not provided any analysis. He gave his ruling. He decided this on the fourth day of a five-day trial. He didn't provide an analysis for us, and that alone is reversible error. Had he done this analysis under Delaware law, the proper result would have been the application of Swiss law to the contract.
So he couldn't, he erred if he relied on the Roche's Swiss law expert's declaration?
Yes, he didn't. Actually, the declaration didn't address whether the state law, the procedure for how to approach the choice of law. The procedure should have been.
The declaration said because it covers all respects, then the scope of the choice of law provision as to whether it went solely to a contract claim or whether it also covered a tort claim, right. As understood the Swiss law expert to say, under Swiss law, that you would construe the scope of the agreement to cover both the tort and the contract claims.
Well, that was his opinion. There was no.
And was that controverted by another Swiss lawyer that you all had?
No, it wasn't, Your Honor.
Well, then why isn't it okay for Judge Farnan to rely on that?
Well, we don't know whether he did or he didn't. We know the result. We don't know the reasoning. We don't know the reasoning.
Well, but I mean, we're capable of looking at the record and see if there's something in there to support what he said, right?
Well, we can look at briefs, but we can't look at the reasoning.
I read the expert to say that the tort claims were swept right in with the contract claims under Swiss law.
That's what he said. But he also said that the choice of law provision must be very specific as to what else is swept in. And so in the record, it was also...
I thought the Swiss expert said, this is most unusual. He said, you know, we see a lot of these Swiss confidential agreements, and they almost never have this in all respects language. So it's very unusual that you would do that.
Yeah.
And then you have to put yourself into the minds of the parties in this most unusual situation to see what they meant to sweep in.
Well, there's actually Delaware law on this issue, though, Your Honor, and it addresses...
On construing Swiss contracts?
No, not on how to interpret Swiss contracts, but basically on how to deal with choice of law provisions. That's the law that should have governed how you deal with choice of law provisions. Now, the Swiss expert we established on cross-examination, he was a member of a firm that actually did work for Roche. He was, I would say, something less than a completely unbiased witness. And we established that on cross-examination. So, but he did say that the choice of law provision must be very, very specific as to what else it sweeps in. And here it spoke about the agreement in all respects. And if you look at that language under Delaware law, it applies the restatement. Yes, that applies to the contract and claims that derive solely from the contract. But as to torts, it does not apply. And Delaware law would require that the restatement apply and apply the most significant relationship test, which is Massachusetts law. So we think that the court erred on that, and that that is a basis for reversing and remanding this case to the district court.
I think the remainder of your argument on the cross appeal, I think we have in the briefs sufficiently. Okay. I think we'd probably better move on in order to save you a couple of minutes.
Okay, great, thank you.
Let's see, the appellant's rebuttal. Mr. Purchase.
Yep, a couple things. One, a correction of something I stated. The Barden-Faulkner electrochemical methods textbook was actually in evidence in Markman. What was new was the expert's testimony, admissions that the texts were a leading text, and was in fact something that they used in teaching their own students. Their testimony, for instance, Dr. Higson's Nova's expert's testimony that a 1,000 micron electrode would in fact have a degree of non-planar diffusion, and his testimony regarding Musho. And how that was a compelling reference, even though it had microelectrodes of substantially over 100 microns in width.
What exactly was the testimony of the expert with respect to the degree of non-planar diffusion? Because I think everybody seems to be in agreement that there is some, at least minimal, degree of non-planar diffusion, even at 1,000 microns. What did he say in particular as to the degree? Because the language in the specification is something along the line of predominantly non-planar.
Well, I come back to that, Your Honor. That was one of the things I was going to address. First of all, the only reference to predominantly
non-planar... Well, yes, but first answer the question, okay, if you would, as to what the expert said, and then we can work from there to what the specs is.
First of all, I think Dr. Higson didn't try to put any kind of a percentage on it.
He just said some? Was that his language?
Yes, he said that there would be some. And Dr. Williams, LifeScan's expert, didn't provide any kind of tests or anything like that that would establish any kind of percentage of non-planar versus planar diffusion at the 1,000 micron limit either. But coming back to this issue of the substantially non-planar, I think you're referring to the third paragraph of the detailed description section again.
I understand your argument that that's a preferred embodiment and so forth, but that's a preferred definition, not an exclusive definition, but it is certainly as close as we get anywhere in the specification to an effort to specify what we're talking about in reference to microelectrodes. So it's pretty important, it seems to me, to the analysis of the case.
Well, it may be, but the sentence starts out with saying a mix of planar and non-planar diffusion. Any mix of planar and non-planar diffusion can be a microelectrode. And there is absolutely no question, I think no dispute, that the term especially modifies that substantially planar reference in that last sentence. I understand a dispute, LifeScan disputes, as to whether it modifies the last if phrase, but there can be no dispute that it modifies the first if phrase. And so I think that any kind of substantially non-planar diffusion reference is clearly a preferred embodiment.
Well, the sentence that gives me some trouble with respect to your position is actually the sentence that says, non-microelectrodes, i.e. macroelectrodes, cause diffusion of an analyte through a solute according to a substantially planar path. So that suggests that if you have a path which is minimally non-planar but substantially planar, then you've got a macroelectrode. That seems to me to be a problem that, and the question then is, does your expert somehow cure that problem?
I would agree with you, Your Honor, if the applicant didn't go on and broaden the definition of a microelectrode by stating that any mix of planar and non-planar paths can also be considered a microelectrode.
Well, that would seem to be inconsistent with the sentence I just read.
Well, inconsistent or clearly broader? Clearly an intent to broaden the scope of a microelectrode.
Well, if it's clearly broader, then it's inconsistent.
And that may be correct, but certainly I think based on one sentence of in this middle of this paragraph, I don't think it's fair to address or assert that in and of itself would be a basis for imposing a limitation on claims, especially when there's a contradictory sentence that states a much broader definition, if there is a definition at all in this paragraph, of a mix of planar and non-planar paths. Furthermore, the claims of the provisional application, as you pointed out, Judge Clevenger, the claim one has no upper limit of 100 microns, it's only when you get to claim two, which would impose such an upper limit. And in fact, the proposed construction that was proposed by defendants would effectively limit the scope of these claims to something narrower than claim one of the provisional application. And I assert that would be an error based again on the intrinsic evidence and something that would be under section 112, part of the original disclosure.
What about the fact that the examples 3 through 5 came into this prosecution late in 2002, I guess it was, after there was already LifeScan's product, I guess, was already on the market. What use can we make of those examples in light of that fact?
Well, I point out that in this court's Martec decision, the court relied upon just that example in connection with that kind of intrinsic evidence, whether it's part of the specification or the prosecution history, to establish that the claims could not be construed more narrowly.
Let's go back to first principles. I mean, suppose I've written a patent application that's clearly, I haven't been very specific, but the better reading of my application would be that it's limited. Let's just use these facts for convenience, to 100 microns. And I say, I see that my competitor's got something at 750 microns. I better find some way to fix this. And so I go to my patent lawyer and I say, what can I do? And he says, I've got an idea. We'll add some examples to the specification. We'll call them microelectrodes and we'll say they're up to 1,000 microns. That can't possibly be a legitimate way to broaden the scope of what previously was a narrower application. Wouldn't you agree with that?
In the abstract, I would agree with you, Your
Honor. All right. Now, what's different about this case from my hypothetical?
Well, first of all, throughout the specification, all of the intrinsic evidence, and I'm referring for starting with the reference to the plain meaning of the term microelectrode in the topic sentence of that third paragraph, the detailed description, as referring persons to the general understanding in the art. The fact that every reference to 100 microns or less in connection with with the width of electrodes is clearly identified as preferred, as special, or typical. Even the mix of planar and non-planar diffusion, and Nova's experts' admission that that the that electrodes of up to 1,000 microns would have a mix of planar and non-planar diffusion. And then there's teachings throughout the specification, and we list them at our Roche's blue brief, for instance, at pages 30 to 32. There's references throughout the specification that give broad teachings of varying the dimensions of the electrodes, including the width, of using larger dimension electrodes, expanding the width. And clearly, in connection with basic intrinsic evidence here, the term microelectrode, claims are going to be limited to microelectrode, extends to the broadest scope of what a microelectrode could or, should be, given the teaching to a person of ordinary skill in the art to vary the dimensions.
Except for exhibits 3, 4, and 5, you can't point to any number bigger than 100.
Other than through the plain meaning.
That's correct. And that's a much harder case for you if exhibits 3, 4, and 5 are out.
You have, again, the plain meaning, the Excalibur report, all of which is part of the intrinsic evidence and establishes that electrodes of up to 1,000 microns are microelectrodes, and then the mix of planar and non-planar diffusion language. But I agree, every limitation to 100 microns, albeit preferred or typical, is clearly not a limitation.
I think we're going to have to leave it there.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Judges. Now, I did not hear anything about the cross appeal in Mr. Judges' rebuttal, so I think there's nothing further to rebut. Unless you heard something, I didn't.
No, you're
okay. Very well. Then we'll leave it there. The case is submitted. We thank all counsel.